Hello, everyone, and welcome to our Invest in Women Symposium. We are thrilled to have you joining us and appreciate you taking the time today during a busy year end. My name is Kelly Baldoni. I lead our Gender Lens Investing platform at Impax. I've been part of the team running this event since our inaugural symposium 5 years ago. And once again, I'm incredibly encouraged by the turnout and the enthusiasm of all of you, our clients and partners dialing in from around the world. Especially after 18 months of virtual meetings, Zoom fatigue, and many competing priorities, it really goes to show that gender lens investing continues to be a focus area and a major theme for sustainable investors. And as many of you know, it's a cornerstone of our work at Impax. Our investment philosophy is centered around the transition to a more sustainable economy, and we believe that gender equality is a key driver in that transition. And it appears that the majority of you agree. In our pre-event survey, 75% of you said that you were already investing with a gender lens and that you'd be interested in expanding that lens to products that consider diversity beyond gender. So our goal today is to inform, but also to inspire the rest of you to join us in directing capital towards companies that value equality, diversity, and inclusion, that understand the economic benefits of advancing women in the workplace, and ultimately move gender lens investing further into the mainstream. Logistically, I've been asked to remind everyone of a few things. If you have technical questions, please drop them in the chat and someone from Impax will assist you. You'll be in listen-only mode for the entirety of the event, but please feel free to use the Q&A box if you have any questions. Our first three sessions today are 45 minutes in length with a 15-minute break between. And for the final hour, you'll have a choice between sessions. So please pick one. And if you're interested in both, not to worry, we are recording all of today's sessions so you can listen later on. So with that, let's get started. We've created what we believe to be a compelling agenda that covers the most important topics around investing in women. And to kick things off, I'm very excited to introduce our first group of speakers, Sally Bridgeland, Chair of Impax Asset Management, Sally Krawcheck, CEO and co-founder of Elevest and our partner on the Pax Elevate Fund, and our moderator for the session, Impax President Joe Keefe. Joe, over to you.
Thank you, Kelly. And welcome to Sally Bridgeland and Sally Krawcheck. It's a real honor to be able to moderate this first panel today, particularly since Sally Bridgeland is the chair of the board of Impax Asset Management, the firm where I run the North American division, and Sally Krawcheck. Sally has been our partner in the launch of the Global Women's Leadership Fund and has been a consultant to us for several years on both the fund and our gender lens investing platform more broadly, and is now the founder and CEO of Elevest. You're both leaders in this space in gender lens investing, in women in finance, in the financial services industry. I want to start by teeing it up for you because, as you know, we did do a survey that Kelly mentioned before this symposium. 173 of the investment professionals who are attending today answered the survey. Well over half said that when evaluating managers to manage money now, they consider EDI broadly, as well as more specifically when it comes to sort of board and senior management diversity, investment team diversity, diversity of ownership, overall team diversity, EDI policies, and so on and so forth. In my view, by the way, our RFP teams here at Impax that are sort of responding to requests for managers, for investment managers, can confirm this, that EDI is at the very top of every questionnaire now. This, in my view, was probably very, very recent. And I want to ask each of you to start by saying it's recent. It's new to the financial services industry. Are we in a moment where it indicates that perhaps the pace of progress will accelerate because more is being asked of us or more will be demanded of us when it comes to gender, specifically in EDI issues more broadly very soon? Sally Bridgeland, I will start with you. You're a chair of a publicly traded company, a seat very seldom occupied by a woman with deep experience in the industry. From where you sit, Are we at a moment of acceleration? Or are we sort of talking the talk, but not quite yet walking the walk?
So I think from a UK perspective, definitely there's no going back from here, which is very encouraging for those of us that have been involved in institutional investment, as I have for the best part of 40 years now. If I look at the various hats that I have, it's just not acceptable in the UK to be presented with a pitch book where all of the faces are white men of all of the roles from an asset manager. And I think that represents the fact that a lot of the institutional investors themselves have more diverse roles. My final executive role was as chief executive of the BP pension fund, and I wasn't alone as being a female chief executive of one of the top 10 pension funds in the UK. So it's not a sort of cliff edge moment. It's something that's been creeping along for a while, and the increased popularity, both with politicians and with investors, of thinking seriously about climate change means that the E, the S, and the G are now all firmly on the agenda in the UK. And it's the diversity bit that is the manifestation of the S at the moment.
Interesting. Sally Krawcheck, I was on the Elevest website not long ago, and it says, you know, Elevest built by women for women. The financial industry wasn't. So, you know, the founding of your company is a direct sort of challenge to this notion of whether we're walking the walk and whether we're really making real progress. Your thoughts?
Well, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. And just as we see the country overall on the coast becoming more and more progressive, more and more liberal, you know, and we see in other parts of the country that they're sort of pulling back into a level of conservatism, you know, with what's going on in the Supreme Court right now, some might say, you know, reactionary in terms of women and women's rights. You know, we've always, you know, I think it's been clear that the industry to date has not because anybody meant to do anything on purpose and, you know, people weren't well-meaning, but, you know, the industry was built by men for men. And remains today, even with, you know, as we look hopefully towards progress, remains by men for men. And I love it, the fact that this group is ahead of the curve is fantastic. But as you said, it's 179 people. It's not the entire industry. So I think we have a ways to go. But, you know, for I know McKinsey is going to be speaking, and they did their Lean In study about diversity in the industry. But their numbers today are that in asset management, it's worse than the overall financial services industry. It's 69% white men. It is, 8% men of color, 3% women of color, and 20% white women. You know, whereas at Elevest, you know, we've built the business differently, and we're 76% women and 50% people of color. So there may be the beginnings of change, but what's always been frustrating about the asset management industry is, you know, the results are clear. They're clear, right? There's performance and it's clear. And nowhere do I think I've seen any research that tells you that women or people of color are worse investors than white men, are worse, you know, wealth managers than white men. But it's been an industry that's done very well by serving a portion of the population extremely well and not serving other portions of the population.
And if the research is so clear, and I think all of us have seen that research, and the research, as I often say, is beyond compelling at this point, it's rather overwhelming that more diverse groups make better decisions, provide better oversight, create more innovation, deliver better business results than more homogeneous groups. You know, if anything else is that plain from research, you'd think people would jump into it, but yet, gender lens investing, arguably, although we're having some success, it's moving more slowly than we thought mm-hmm. it would 5-10 years ago. Mm-hmm. the numbers are moving more slowly than I think we all thought they would in terms of women's representation on board and leadership 5-10 years ago. What accounts for the fact that, you know, if all the research suggested to invest in soybeans, all of a sudden money would be pouring into soybeans or whatever. But the research is suggesting that you should invest in diversity. But I think there's a lag. Why? Sally Bridgeland, any thoughts on that?
I think part of it has to be the element of discomfort that people will feel if they're being forced to face up to a reality that doesn't, that has a certain amount of dissonance with the stories, the culture, for everything they've believed in. The reality of the history of the City of London and financial services institutions is it's not just that they're white and male. They're white and male from a certain background and certain schools where there are certain hierarchies and certain ways of behaving that have meant that changing those is particularly challenging. And what it's taken is a kind of first generation of women who really are not behaving like women, they're behaving like men because they need to lean in the sort of Sheryl Sandberg sense and behave like men to change things so that then women can behave like women. I'm lucky enough to be in the sort of second or third generation where, you know, I don't have to wear a grey suit or a navy suit or a black suit to fit in with the way that people might expect me to look and behave. I can be me. I can talk about understanding testosterone from having a teenage son, which I do. But there would be certain things that if people, it just won't resonate with them. And I think one of a really interesting conversation that we had at the board at IMPAX last year was, what do we mean by inclusion? And I've got a bit of a sort of soundbite, which is diversity is a statistic and you can buy your way out of it. You can solve the gender pay gap just by paying women more money. But inclusion is a way of life. It's a cultural shift. It's valuing voices equally. And we had a really interesting conversation with the men and women around the table as to what it meant to them and what the challenges were. And I just can't imagine that conversation having happened, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. So, and that's absolutely great. But equally, there are other boardrooms and places and companies where I can't imagine that happening. And if it did happen, it might suddenly make people realize that, well, actually, we might have been missing a trick all these years. And it's that sense of regret and dissonance that I think means that it isn't changing as quickly, because they have to realize that, well, actually, we should have been doing things differently. One of the first behavioral finance papers I read was Terry O'Dean's Boys Will Be Boys, which was all about how women investors make better risk-adjusted returns than men. The reality is the combination of men and women is even more powerful. You get the best of both if you've got the right kind of inclusive behavior. And really, that's what we're aiming for. But it is quite a different behavioral mindset to be able to accommodate that when compared to the traditional way of running things and making decisions.
Well, as you said, the research, what you said, the best combination is both. And that's what the research says. But to Sally Bridgeland's point, Sally Krawcheck, notwithstanding that, the money's not following sort of the research, if you will, or the facts, or as quickly as you would think if the message was so obvious. So suggesting there are other deep-seated problems or deep-seated sort of challenges that we have that have to be addressed at the same time, but the numbers are just not going to move as quick as we'd like them to.
Yeah. So I agree with everything Sally just said. About people, you know, if you've got a great job and you're working with people like you who you've worked with for years and you can finish each other's, not only your sentences, but their thoughts, and your families are friends and you're making a lot of money and the stock price is going up, you know, the best and the brightest, Joe, the best and the brightest, right? That, and there's no way to prove the counterfactual, which is if you were a bit more uncomfortable and you had greater diversity, your stock price would be much higher. And in fact, you'd be making much more because, you know, you can't prove that, right? But I think what's also really important are the stories we tell ourselves and how hard it is to break out of the stories we tell ourselves. And when I was founding Elevest, going to talk to, you know, CEOs of big financial companies, Wall Street companies, asset management companies, hey, should we partner on this? Women don't invest as much as men do. You know, here's an opportunity. It's a, you know, to solve a societal problem, you know, advance women, make society better, make a lot of money, you know, build a big business, all that stuff. And, you know, you just go through the whole thing. And even after all the facts, 90% of women manage their money on their own at some point in their lives, 80% of women die single, yes, but don't their husbands manage their money for them? What? I just said 90% manage, but don't their husbands manage it for them? And that's from their worldview. At the same time, you know, the other thing you hear is, well, women are risk averse. And we've all heard it. And in fact, most of us on the call may still believe it, you know, rather than, huh, women aren't investing as much as men are. Well, the answer is obviously they're risk averse. Or maybe there's another answer, which is we didn't build the business for them. That in a business that has, you know, moved on, but used to be trading. And in certain parts of it, you know, are, you know, trading Bitcoin and meme stocks. You know, gosh, who wouldn't love that? Women must be risk averse, rather than women are looking for a different way. And women want to see themselves, even if they can't articulate it, reflected in the people that they work with. But these messages have been internalized because we've received them since childhood, that boys are good at coding and math and money, and girls are good at English and history and painting. And, you know, the stat that just always floors me is that while today 72% of articles written directed to men about money are about growth and investing and advancing and abundance, 90% of the articles written to women are scarcity and don't buy the latte and don't have the facial and budgeting and saving and financial planning is hard. And so she, oh, that's, you know, men are like, oh, money, power, strength, independence. Women, isolation, uncertainty. And we've been socialized, all genders have been socialized in this way. And so it's very, you know, well, okay. I know diversity might work in the retail industry, but in our industry, you know, they don't even want to do it and they're not that good at it. Well, here's the research. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And again, it's men and women, all genders believe it. So women are like, woo, I think I'm going to go become a journalist, not become a financial advisor.
And, you know, both of you have thought a lot about and have a lot of background in sort of retirement. Sally, Sally Bridger, you've been in the pension industry. Sally Krawcheck, I've heard you say, you know, the retirement crisis is a women's crisis. So what you're both talking about inevitably leads to a wealth gap that becomes more pronounced as women get older and get closer to retirement. And that wealth gap, arguably, you know, it's not being closed by, you know, a certain number of women who are achieving certain levels of professionalism and compensation and whatnot. But broadly, societally, there's still a huge wealth gap that is, in fact, a huge gender gap. I wonder if some thoughts on that, because that, you know, that's going to affect too women on the lower end of the wage scale, women in the middle class, with the you know, women in the services industries. The industries have been hardest by the pandemic. We'll talk about that in a moment. But there's a real retirement gap that's very problematic for sort of baby boomers who are getting to that age now. That is fundamentally sort of on gender lines.
Maybe pensions is the girly part of financial services, because it is about saving. It's about saving for old age. Women live longer than men. You know, that there's there were quite a lot of themes there. And right. certainly my motivation for going into pensions was to help improve what society would be like in those older ages. But yes, the pensions gap is huge in the UK compared to even the gender pay gap. And it has received a lot of publicity here. And you're right, and COVID has made this worse, but we were already seeing in the UK quite a gap between those women who were working essentially in what would have been called men's jobs in the past, and a very divided sisterhood. And there's a book called The XX Factor that was written by one of the great professors at King's College. And she'd identified this split sisterhood between those who are in the service industry, essentially doing the same kind of jobs that women had always done, and those who were living the lifestyle of men and were behaving like men and paid like men. And that's why I think there is still these opportunities for gender lens investing, because things aren't equal and there is still advances to be made, because you haven't reached that point where there is that parity. There will be a day at some point in the future when it isn't necessarily the same investment case, in the same way as a transition to a sustainable economy. We hope we're going to get there on some of those aspects. And when we get there, we can stop investing in those. They won't be the investment opportunities that they are now. Mm-hmm. But we are a long way from that, certainly on the gender front.
And in the U.S., Sally Krawcheck, I know you've thought about this, but in August, 4 million jobs were lost. That's 3% of the U.S. workforce. In September, over 4 million jobs were lost. That's another 3% of the U.S. workforce. 10 million jobs were unfilled. If you look at it, a lot of those are in service industries, retail, food service, healthcare, sort of social assistance jobs where job categories where women are overrepresented. Yeah. Such that the sort of, we've heard talking all the news about the great resignation. You almost think people are just resigning because they have enough money and they can pick and choose and they can wait for a better job and so forth. But in fact, a lot of it's driven by having kids home from school with COVID, having unavailable or unaffordable childcare. Talk to that, if you will, for a moment, because that seems to me to be, an after effect sort of laid bare by the pandemic that we're not fully sort of talking about yet.
Yeah, yeah. So as Jessica Calarco said, what we learned during the pandemic is other countries have social safety nets and the U.S. has women. And the U.S. in particular has women of color. And that when things fall apart, it falls on the shoulders of women. The wealth gap in the United States, the gender wealth gap, the racial wealth gap, were pre the pandemic getting worse. Whereas the gender pay gap, which we talk about so much, was getting a bit better. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was still going to be, decades for Black women to close their gap and 100 plus years for Latinx women. It was at least moving in the right direction. The gender wealth gap was already moving in the wrong direction. And, to sort of put a fine point on it, what that means is the truth that Black millennial women have less wealth than the generation of women before them at the same age. And they're just, of course, but there just seems to be something like these, accomplished, driven women, are just being held back. Student loan debt, for example, the fact that they haven't invested as much and so haven't had the power of compounding, the fact that they've had more credit card debt and so had the negative impact of compounding. And, this wedge is just increasing. And if you think it's bad now, wait until Roe v. Wade is overturned, because the economic and financial impact that has on women, and particularly women of color, the way it will change their lives if they are unable to receive, safe abortions and are forced to have children, regardless of, you think it's bad now? It's getting worse. And so again, I want to be optimistic about all of this, but this country, you know, in terms of its treatment of women and the building of wealth of women has been going in the wrong direction. And let me just flip this. You know, we always hear, if you want to improve a society, get more money in the hands of women. Hear it all the time. Developed society, 90 cents of that dollar goes into her family and her community, whereas for men, they, you know, only a dime of it does. Developed countries, same difference. You know, the politics moderate. You know, look at Scandinavia, right? You know, versus other countries. So you see a moderation of the society when the power is more evenly distributed amongst the, you know, the ethnic breakdowns and amongst the genders. So is it any surprise that in the United States of America, where we are getting angrier and angrier, where Ray Dalio literally said there is a 33% chance of a civil war in the next handful of years, which you initially look at and you're like, no. And you're like, well, when people protest, they are getting shot at. Huh, that, I don't know, that sort of sounds like in my history books, beginnings of war, right? Boston Tea Party, I don't know. But is it any wonder then if societies get better when women have more money that our society is getting angrier as women and particularly women of color have less money relative to others, then why wouldn't the opposite be the case? So I think this is, you know, sort of red alarm, you know, double red alarm stuff.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you make that connection because I do think that, you know, deep-seated inequalities, you know, we're talking about EDI. So let's talk about the E in EDI for a moment, equality, deep-seated persistent historical inequalities and biases and prejudices have the most pernicious effects at time of sort of crisis and division. And we're experiencing that in the US right now. And, you know, we're also coming out of a pandemic where everyone's talking about the future of work. So, it's going to be more virtual meetings and it's going to be less travel and it's going to be more hybrid workplaces and more accommodation and flexibility. And, that's all fine. But are we really talking about the issues that are going to address the persistent sort of inequality that's affecting certain parts of the population, underpaid, overworked? In the U.S., this is different than the U.K., Sally Bridgeland, no parental leave, no paid parental leave, you know, increasingly unavoidable childcare, the sort of infrastructure that sort of allows for work and allows for meaningful work is in a bit of disarray. So I'm just wondering, so, you know, the E in EDI, we talk a lot about diversity, but the E in EDI gets less attention, as does the I in inclusion. You know, women, inclusion is sort of being seen, being valued, being heard, having a voice, having power, right? And so you can move the numbers, but you're not necessarily going to create job environment, a workplace environment where women can actually have power and change things. And it seems to me that that's something too that's coming out a little bit of the pandemic, where we're talking about the future work, but we're not really talking about the issues that are going to allow for real equality, real inclusion, real diversity to flourish. We're just talking about that in terms of the numbers moving, in terms of sort of the underlying conditions that need to be changed to sort of enable, you know, women to participate fully in the workforce. I don't know, Sally Bridgeland, I know it's different in the UK because, as Sally said, you do have a social safety net. We have women. You do have parental leave. We have not. So the circumstances are different. You're probably not as far down the sort of social, the divisive social sort of path that Sally just referenced, sort of the divisions that are plaguing our country at the moment. But these problems are real. I mean, the I in EDI, the E in EDI are getting short shrift, it seems to me.
Yeah, and I think, you know, although we might have the social, different kinds of social safety nets, it's not just about parental leave in the first year of a child's life, okay? Children live for a very long time. And the reality also in the UK is that older age care is a problem.
Yeah.
and old people don't want to live in homes because I don't want to live in homes.
Women do most of the elder care.
Women do most of the
almost all
care.
Of it.
So I think there are two challenges with a different way of working. One is that then means that you can say, that's the solution to the old age care and childcare problem, which means that which will fall more heavily on women in the UK as well as it will in the US. Yeah, that has been the reality. That's what's happened during the pandemic. People are expected to juggle things more. So that's one thing. So they're more likely to want to work from home. And the reality is most of the people who are in power in the workplace are more likely to want to work in the office, because guess what? That's how they succeeded in getting where they were in the first place. So their idea of what success is about, their blueprint for what makes a chief executive, a chief anything, a promotional prospect, is still based on the way that they did things and presenteeism. You know, that will be a danger, which will still militate against that, the equality in the workplace, because you might find that a lot of the grafting might still be being done by women working from home in the same way as it used to be. I was talking to a guy earlier who was talking about the different floors. They used to have a separate male and female entrance to the insurance company that he worked in, and the women worked and did all the calculations in one room, and the men worked and did all their evaluations and other stuff in another room. You know, the reality is it's women working at home and men working in the office. That bias could continue just because of habit and the way that we've done things in the past, and that might get worse because of the lacks of social safety nets and the demographic shifts that mean that we need to take more care of the elderly as well as the kids.
So flexible work environments might not be so flexible. They might sort of underscore historical.
They might be flexible, challenges. But they might not be as equal.
Yeah.
You know, that might challenge, unless we rethink what we mean by promotion and career progression. And I think there is a big challenge around that. It's actually, what does a career look like? What does the employment contract look like these days? Is it about a progression in job titles? Is it about diversity of skills? How do we make sure people who are working flexibly get the same opportunities as those that are putting their hand up because they're in the office?
Sally Krawczyk, your thoughts on this? I mean, it seems to me that work, we're talking about the future of work, but we're not designing it in a way that really, you know, sort of tackles the E's and the I's of the EDI landscape.
Yeah, I underscore everything Sally just said. I mean, flexibility is a fantastic thing if it is offered and accessed evenly. And we've all know about you get paid maternity leave, but the non-primary caregivers don't, therefore we've got a mommy track and a daddy track, right? So a place where there's good that folks are trying to do, and there's a second and third order effect. And by the way, as we all probably know, that's exactly where the gender pay gap starts, is when he gets a daddy bonus and she gets a mommy tax. So I think flexibility is similar. If it's going to be, if it's going to just be accessed by one group of folks, and then you have second class and first class citizens. You know, at Elevest, we made the decision to go remote first, so that everybody is working from different places and we're bringing people together at certain times. So it's time for the budgeting or it's time for the brainstorming. You know, we'll fly people in from all over the country, but mostly building a culture, you know, that is a Zoom culture. Overall. So look, it's not easy. You know, none of it's easy when you have these embedded expectations and culture and views. It's well past time to quit. Oh, the pipeline. We just need a pipeline. We got to have the pipeline. Yeah. And recognize that the pipeline's been there all along, though, you know, women and people of color just simply haven't been promoted. They've been in. But a number of the Wall Street firms are seeing that now. We thought they left, but actually they just are stuck, you know, at the bottom. And so being really thoughtful and, you know, intentional about these things. And if you're not, you know, before women had one, you know, well, you go work someplace else and maybe it'd be good, maybe it wouldn't be, you go home. I'd say a glimmer of really good news is that the cost of starting businesses is so tiny now that you can start a business from your computer in your kitchen. And if you want, you know, seed and Series A, they are more available. You know, crowdfunding is more available. And so I think companies that, you know, don't provide this, whereas women didn't have a lot of options in the past, there are maybe not a ton of them, but there are increasing options.
Yeah. And in a way, it sounds to me a little bit like you're saying, to some extent, are ED and I still so connected at the hip, such that really progress on E, equality, and progress on I, inclusion, really still requires us basically to move the numbers on D. In other words, there's research that suggests that, you know, there's 30%. When women achieve 30% of a leadership team, that behavior actually changes. That's where you really see the different conversations, the increased innovation. You'll see company policies and practices change as a result of having more diverse leadership. And this is a loaded question because I'm asking, and is that really where investors can probably help the most right now? It's like, look for investment opportunities, whether it be in a fund or in an investment platform that offers solutions and products like Elevest or whatnot, where women are, you know, get behind companies that are seriously committed to advancing women, where the numbers clearly show it. And if that's the sort of best thing or the most important thing investors can do right now?
Money is power. Money is power. You know, how we direct it determines who wins and loses. You know, we as women, we control several $1 trillion of investable assets. If women stood up tomorrow, and that's just in the United States, and women stood up tomorrow and say, I don't want to invest in companies that don't reflect me, that, you know, have got fewer than 30% of the board or women, fewer than 30% of the leadership team or women, just don't withhold my money, it would change. Women direct 85% of consumer spending. If we said we're just not going to buy from companies that don't reflect us, it would change. And in fact, 90% of women say they want to buy from women-owned businesses. You know, the challenge is just the knowledge, right? What we, if anybody wants to go start a business, it should be the app that dings, you know, when you're on a web, you know, sort of brings up when you're on a website, what the board composition is of the company who you're looking at buying from, what the leadership team composition is, whether they've got paid, you know, parental leave, whether they got paid elderly, like there'd be, you know, there'd be a, I'm going to start a new business, Joe. There'd be the plug-in, right? And bing, the numbers, and you get a grade, yeah. And you're like, okay, fine. And then you'd be walking through the street, bing, 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 you know, don't go into that pizza shop, not right. That pizza shop, right? That's a very, very bigoted pizza shop. But so I think some of it is going to, you know, if we decide to, it will be done. The challenge still, which will get solved over time, is the lack of information to enable us to make those in the moment decisions.
Yeah, yeah. I want to, we're running out of time. We have a few minutes, but it's a question I want to ask both of you that I want to get in. And Sally Bridgeland, I'm sorry I didn't have you jump in on that last one, but feel free to in the first part of your answer on this one. But I want to ask each of you, right now, where do you look for real hope? Where do you see real progress? What, you know, leaving on a positive note, where is the real good work being done? And what can we point to say that's making a difference, that can make a difference? We have to support that, do more of that. I think gender lens investing is part of that. But let me, your thoughts, Sally Bridges, let's start with you.
The reality of ESG, certainly in the UK, is that people are realizing that there isn't a trade-off between money and impact. You can get both. So I think that there are two elements of hope that I have. One is that we do start thinking of funds on a more thematic basis. And it's not just thinking about, I love the word intentionality is not used very much in the UK, but there's something about that in terms of whether it's a theme around gender lens or transition to the sustainable economy, people want their investment funds to be meaning something and purposeful, as well as making their money. So that's one thing of hope. And the other thing of hope is the next generation of men, because the next generation of men have been brought up and educated alongside talented women, and they have got to be man enough to be in the market with those talented women. And there's something about the way that men's attitudes are changing in the UK, whether it's because they've got daughters who have been educated and are struggling to have the same opportunities in the workplace, or whether they're just seeing it in their partners and their school friends. There's hope from the male side, and the sort of him for her, he for she or whatever approach,
yeah,
as well as just the men. And I know, and I'm sure everyone in certainly in the actuarial profession, which is very male dominated, we've all had fantastic mentors who've definitely been on our side, and you supporting that, encouraging that, and being an advocate for that side of things, and it being okay and not being embarrassed about it. That's yeah, my sort of glimmer of hope to get, yeah, over that cultural aversion or the dissonance I was talking about earlier.
Yeah. And Sally Krawczyk, what are you optimistic about? Where do you see that?
Young women. You know, Gloria Steinem has said that women, and I'd say particularly white women in this case, are the only group that become more radical as they age. That, you know, historically, young women, I don't need to be a feminist. It's okay. All, you know, 40% of my training class are women. I've been asked on a business trip. You know, everybody seems to like to have me around. Those older women are so bitter. You know, no wonder they didn't make it. They're so angry. And then, you know, you're sort of in your 30s and you got the first kid and you got the second kid and the marriage is a little on the rocks and the dog is sick and the parents are da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We've all been there, right? You're holding on by your fingertips. And then the kids go away to college or university. And, you know, you look around at the age of 48, march. And, typically the women in their 20s, like, they're so angry. You know, I don't want to be a feminist. They're just angry, like they hate men. And young women now, at least in the United States, are like, you know what? We got to march. And so, you know, you see them taking control. You know, we've got a pretty good beat on them. You see them taking control over their money in a way that we just weren't even seeing a few years ago. That the slight silver lining of the pandemic is they realized they were going backwards, and they realized it was on a relative basis. And so the women in their 20s, my, you know, nieces, et cetera, are like, we're taking this bull by the proverbial horns.
Right. All right. Well, the men of the next generation and the women of the next generation. So I guess that's where we'll place our faith. Kelly is back. Sally, thank you so much. Always great being with you. Really appreciated the conversation today. Kelly, I'll hand it back to you.
Thanks, Joe. And thanks, Sally, for sharing your perspective on this. It's a powerful and thought-provoking start to our event, so we appreciate it. We now have about 15 minutes before our next session. We hope that you'll join us. The session is on gender data, the progress that's been made, and the challenges that persist. You'll have to close this session to rejoin the next. You'll have a link in your email to that session. So we hope to see you again in about 15 minutes. Thank you.